Okay, let's start off on page 29. And I just have a couple of comments on 29. I just thought that there were one really important comment and one nice way to say something. The first one, of course, where he says, Thoreau said that most people lead lives of quiet desperation. Judaism, argues Ben Pazzi, is a way of living life in quiet celebration. And I thought that was really nice. Just gives you a different perspective on the Jewish attitude toward life. Then the comment that I want to make is at the bottom of the page. It's actually the next to the last sentence in the last paragraph. Ritual creates continuity. On the cruise ship, I lecture a lot on cultural history because I'm talking about the different ports that we go to. And I always try to make the point to the audience that there are two really fundamental factors that influenced Mediterranean culture. And the first is economics, and the second is religion. You can't talk about the cultures of the Mediterranean without talking about religion. Why? Because religion is the glue that holds the society together. And of course, that's exactly what he's saying here. Ritual, those things that you perform time after time after time with cultural memory, are what create the glue that holds the society together. So if you think about it in those terms, and you think about the loss of ritual, that is, what happens, for example, when we lose the various elements that have given us social continuity? So, for example, and a good example just happened politically. What happens when you change Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day? I mean, think about it. It shifts the culture, right? It might seem like, oh, it's just vocabulary, but it's not vocabulary. What would happen in America if you took away Thanksgiving? What would happen in the Western world if you no longer had the ritual of Christmas? Or in Judaism, what would happen if you stopped observing Shabbat? Those rituals are not just cultural markers. They're actually the thing that keeps people glued together during times of potential conflict and separation. So one of the things that you recognize about the Jewish population is that it's been able to maintain its identity in spite of all the different empires that have come and gone, because it has anchored itself in the rituals of the biblical text. It's not just reading Torah. It's actually the rituals that come from that, right? The practice of Yom Kippur, the practice of Rosh Hashanah, all of those things, rituals, glue the society together over centuries and over enormous conflict that keeps it going, right? So I think it's really, his comment, it's just three words, but it really is important to understand. Lise, you were going to say something?
I find that whole concept interesting, but would you not say that also it has to be, like the ritual has to be understood? And the problem with maybe today in our generation, those rituals are there, but we don't understand the depth of them in Western civilization. In Judaism, they understand the depth of each ritual because they go back to the scriptures to understand where it comes from. But we're not living in history anymore. So we, you know, people, Thanksgiving is Thanksgiving, but it doesn't maybe have the same power as if they understood why. You know, we have Thanksgiving.
Yeah, but I don't think, I think ritual can function without the depth of understanding. In other words, most people have no idea why America, even Americans, they think celebrating 4th of July is fireworks and hot dogs. But what they don't understand is, they might not understand the depth of it, but the fact that they mutually celebrate it welds them together, right? It's a ritual, a practice that puts people on the same ground, the same playing field, and something that they can take with them time after time after time, right? Now, it might be that the ritual is much deeper than what they understand, but the ritual itself will provide continuity. That's why if you want to really disintegrate a society, you need to change its language base, right? Redefine the words and alter its cultural rituals. And when you do that, you can destroy the society. You can undermine it. You can take it away, which is why when the Jews were overrun by other kingdoms, assimilation was the biggest concern. Because if you assimilate into another culture, you lose your own previous rituals and language, and you adopt the language and rituals of the new culture. And that means that your previous culture disappears.
In Judaism, the nice thing is because of the rituals and the so many holidays or hagim, that if you go to one country or another country, whether you understand their language or not, you can participate in the pick the Sukkot or Rosh Hashanah or Passover, and you can walk into a synagogue and something is going to be familiar, whether you are whichever branch you come from, and you are connected as a family. In some ways.
Yeah. So think about a modern political world that we live in, where one of the critical factors is the replacement of ritual with new events, like for example, tearing down old statues to remove that part of the culture. It does more than just take down the statue. It does something about affecting the way that people think about the culture. And I think that's the really important part that he's making, or point that he's making. And what really now means, what it means for Leviticus is the ritual establishing book of the Bible. It tells you what the rituals are and how they should be performed. And yes, it gives you the depth, but the fact is that if you're practicing them, even without the depth, you're already entering into a culture where, as Lindy says, you can identify with the ritual no matter where you are in the world. And that glues that culture together. Okay, let's go over to page 30.
Skip, can I say something?
Yeah, sure. Of course.
When I light my Shabbat candles, both to begin and end Shabbat, it does something. It really does sanctify that time. It sets a boundary around it. And I also feel connected, even though I'm here in my home by myself, I still feel connected to everybody that's lighting their candles. It's a really important. But even down to the basic human need for habits to stay off chaos, it really does. Like our whole, and that's what this book is about, is to do the chaos in your life. So it just fascinates me. And I love the way I love this book. Thank you so much.
Maggie, I just want to make a very quick second comment. They say that a huge percentage of youth who does not in any way, shape, or form in Israel relate to a specific kind of Judaism are starting since October the 7th, have started keeping Shabbat.
Yep. And I think it's because those rituals provide cultural glue. I feel a part of something. Lise, you wanted to add one more thing? Or David?
Yeah. Reading another book of Heschel there, one of his excerpts from all of his writings that his daughter and his wife put together, I can't remember the name, but he would propose that the youth are hungry, but they don't understand the purpose. And because they don't understand the purpose, I mean, tradition without purpose behind it seems to leave them in an empty space.
I think that's true. So how do you overcome that? You have to have the tradition, the ritual, right? But it's the responsibility of the previous generation to fill in the purpose.
Exactly.
I can't make it up on my own. I can't assign any purpose I want, right? It's not an allegory. So now I'm responsible for training my children. This is what this means. This is why we do this, right?
And yeah, that's exactly what Heschel is talking about also.
Yeah, and that's exactly what God tells Moses. What does he say? Yeah. When your children ask, this is what you're to tell them, right? Your responsibility.
If you read the Shema, there's not just one little paragraph. You keep reading, and if you read the next two, it tells you why and what's.
Yeah. Okay, let's go over to 30. So on 30, I'm talking about the first full paragraph. It says, all this is true, but such beliefs are alien to Judaism. Faith is not magic or a pre-technological technology. More than any other group in ancient Israel, the priests envisioned God in the most austere terms, shorn of any anthropomorphic language or anything that been mistaken for myth. God is wholly other, and it is one of the tasks of the priest to ensure that the worship of God remains wholly other. We serve God not to bring success, but to stay close to him, because he is clarity in a world of confusion, life in a world too often obsessed with death, the enduring presence in the midst of change. Ritual for Torah Kohanim has nothing to do with its role in primitive societies. Okay, so I would say, I would agree with part of this. I will disagree with some of it. I think the middle of it, where he says, we serve God not to bring success, but to stay close to him because he brings clarity, etc. I think that's absolutely true, right? The Bible does not support in any way a prosperity gospel which says that the closer I get to God, the more successful I will be, okay? That's not what it's about at all. It's about, as he says, it's about engaging in the presence of God. It's experiencing that presence. And I think that's really, really important, because it moves us away from a theology of cognitive expression into a theology of spiritual emotion. And I think that's what keeps people going. You know, it's not my mental capacity to understand theology. It's the experience that I have when I draw close to the presence of God. Okay, that much I agree with. But the beginning of it sounds way too much to me like the kinds of things that happen when Christian theology begins to adopt Greek philosophy. In other words, when I start thinking of God as the holy other, that might be true, but I don't see that in the biblical expression. What I mean is, I certainly see God as the sovereign of the universe, but to express God as the holy other smacks to me of a language that says that God is so different from us that we cannot comprehend him at all, that our language can't express anything about him, and that in essence, he's completely unknown. Okay? Now, Heschel actually remarks about this, and I'm surprised that Jonathan Sacks goes in this direction, because what Heschel says is that the Bible never talks about the essence of God at all. That's a philosophical issue, right? What is God really like? And the answer is, how would I know? You know, I'm human. He's divine. I can't think like he does. I can't, et cetera, et cetera. So I push God into the outer reaches of whatever, and I have no ability to connect with the holy other God. Okay, that's a philosophical idea. You will find that in philosophy under the rubric of being with a capital B. God is being with a capital B. What does that mean? I can't experience that at all. All I can only experience things that are, not being as a abstract concept. So when Jonathan Sacks starts talking like that, I think that that's an influence of Greek philosophy showing up in Jewish thinking about the second or the third century BCE and presenting this idea that somehow God is so different that we can't even imagine what he's like. And you see that in Christian theology all the time. When we come up to some irresolvable contrast, it's often the case that a Christian will say, well, God's ways are not my ways. You know, God's ways are not our ways. We can't think like him. You hear it at funerals all the time. Why did this person die? Well, God's ways are our ways. We can't understand him. That's to cast God in a role beyond human capacity. Okay? But I don't see that in the Bible at all. I see everything that happens in the Bible as God expressing himself in ways that human beings can understand, and that intentionally communicating in human language. What's one of the theologians says, God comes dressed in human clothing, right? So the biblical approach is very anthropomorphic, right? God feels, God laughs, God rejoices, God gets angry, God forgets, God remembers, all those kinds of things that are very human, that if God were the holy other, none of those would apply to him, right? And so theologians are apt to say, well, that's just anthropomorphic. And what they mean is that God really isn't like that at all, but we just use those expressions because otherwise we couldn't understand them at all, right? But from the biblical perspective, that's all the terms I have. So why wouldn't I say that expresses God? That really is what God is, because that's what he's told me he's like. And who am I to say, oh, he's really not like that. He's really this quote unquote philosophical idea of perfection, which doesn't allow any of those kind of attributes or qualities. Okay. So I think this paragraph treads on two different playing fields at the same time. One of those is philosophical theology, which is all about the essence of being. The other is my experience of God in the biblical text, which is very much in the human world. Okay? And I opt for the human world. In fact, even in my dissertation, I talked about the fact that the true expression of God is not anthropomorphic, it's theomorphic. It's God dressed in human garb. Right? And when you think about the idea of Leviticus, if the purpose of Leviticus and the ritual of Leviticus is for us to draw close to God and for him to draw close to us, then how in the world could that ever happen if he's so different that I can't even comprehend him? Right? I don't get that piece at all. That seems to me to be a philosophical addition to the text to satisfy the philosopher's quest for absolutes. Okay? Anyway, long diatribe to tell you. There's something else going on here, okay? Yes.
I think that messes, the reason that's, you know, that messes with the Trinity and all the other things that come into play. That's why it has to be. I mean, you have to do that. So otherwise you can't explain.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. If you follow my philosophical work in from the dissertation on, you will see that my argument is that the Greek notion of perfection is what pushes us down this road. Okay? That as soon as we start thinking about perfect, what we mean is something that can never be other than what it is. Because obviously if it changed, it wasn't perfect before. And if anything happens that would cause it to change, then it must have been imperfect. And if it's perfect, it can't have any other change at all. That this is basically Aquinas, Augustine, Boethius arguing this, okay? Comes from Parmenides, all right? But if that's true, then every attribute that we ascribe to God that has anything to do with change is fallacious, is ultimately not true, okay? So I don't see that in the biblical text at all. In fact, I've argued that you won't even find the word perfect attached to God anywhere in the biblical text. Nowhere. Nowhere does the Bible say God is perfect, because that leads me down the wrong path. Okay? So, Esther, you had your hand up?
Yes, I'm a little disappointed in myself that I did not detect that Greek influence in the text, because when I was reading it, I thought he was talking about how it's holy other than the other gods around who created the ritual of magic, whereas we know that, like he says, fate is in our hands, and we don't play the magic trick with the god. That's how I read it.
Yes.
So I'm looking at it in a whole new way.
No, you don't feel bad at all, because he is talking about how God is different from the pagan deities. Because remember, the pagan deities are incredibly human, right? I mean, they're jealous. They have fits of envy, on and on and on. So we don't see that in God, right? But but it isn't so what we're presented in Western thinking is this dichotomy. On the one hand, God totally removed from the world, and on the other hand, God eminently involved in the world. And what I'm saying is there's an in-between ground. We don't have to jump all the way to outside the universe, time and space and everything else to come up with the Jewish idea, the Hebraic idea of God. We don't have to go clear to the philosophical end. We just have to realize that whatever we know about God, he reveals to us in human terms so that we can understand what it is. And it's perfectly legitimate. It's perfectly legitimate for us to say, but this is the way God really is. So when God says in Genesis 6 that he was sorry he ever created man, that's real. It isn't just made up, I feel it. He really was sorry, right? Well, a lot of implications to that that philosophers don't like. So,
it's moving from speculation to relationship.
Yes, hopefully that's true. Right. So there's a big difference. If you allow the Greek philosophical stream to start affecting how you think about God, then as Phyllis says, you're pushed into this really awkward place because, and this is basically what happens with the Trinity, because the Trinity postulates that there is a God who is beyond space and time, and that he manifests himself as God in human form, right? And then he is elevated back into divine status after the resurrection. Well, what does that mean? That means that the elevated Messiah, who is God, is somebody I can't relate to, because he's outside of space and time, because he's now been removed from my arena. So what does that mean? I have to have somebody that I can relate to, and who will that be? Well, the mother of God, of course. So I introduce Mary as the one who's the intercessor, no longer Jesus, because he's God, right? I need a human intercessor, and that becomes Mary, right? Okay, let's go to 31. Oh, sorry, on 30. He's the next paragraph. He says, in Judaism, it's something else entirely different. Emil Durkheim, one of the founders of sociology and a man whose father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were all rabbis, showed how ritual creates and sustains the group. That's what we've argued, right? Ritual creates a collective identity. I underline that because it's so important to understanding how important ritual and ultimately religious ritual is to a society. So in my view, when you exile God from a society, you're on your way to destruction. If you get rid of ritual, you will collapse the society. And all you have to do is think about the left's intention of reestablishing every single ritual that ever made the West what it is. And the intention, of course, is to destroy the West. So let's go on on page 31 now. Okay. He says, ritual does not, this is almost the end of the first paragraph. Ritual does not speak. It enacts. So for David, I don't actually need to have the cognitive explanation in order to practice it. That's what he's saying. Okay. Then he says, it communicates meaning not by saying, but by doing. Ritual inducts us into a world of shared values. That the whole point is, I don't need to have the philosophical, theological explanation in order to practice the ritual. I might have no idea how really deep Shabbat goes, but I know that I'm going to light the candles, I'm going to say the prayers, I'm going to not do certain things, et cetera, and just by practicing that, I enter into, as Pam said, shared values with other people all around the world, and now I have a collective identity that keeps me stable in the middle of chaos, because there are other people who are doing the same thing, whether they understand all the depth or not, I'm still connected to them. So Leviticus is going to give us an explanation of some of the rituals, not all of them, as Sachs has already said. You don't have to explain all this stuff. You just have to know what to do, right? And those shared values are what keeps me connected to the community. Okay, let's go.
Skip, just one thing. Because I come from a Catholic background, Catholic yes. rituals are off the map. But it never changed society, because today the churches are empty. So even
okay, but wait a minute. Yeah, but let's talk about that, okay? Let's really talk about that, because I went to a Catholic church in Naples today. It was filled with people all going through the ritual. Do they not understand what they're doing? Probably not. But guess what? They will be there next Sunday doing the same thing again. And then I look at the age group, because what I discover, of course, is that it's most of the people who grew up in the ritual, right? Whereas the contemporary Catholic Church, actually it's on resurgence again, because people are looking for ritual because they feel so disconnected from life. But in the middle of that age span, there was a whole time when you rejected the rituals. You might not have known why. You just rejected the rituals, and therefore you deliberately disconnected yourself from the identity with that community. Maybe you didn't like what the community stood for, and so you stopped practicing the ritual. What does that mean? It means that society was diminished by the fact that those people weren't practicing the ritual. It's no different. Look, I'm sure Lindy can tell us. It's no different when Jews stop practicing, you know, Jewish rituals, when they stop doing Shabbat, when they stop going to, you know, to services. I mean, it's the same thing. When you stop the ritual, you disconnect from the community. And if enough people disconnect from the community in assimilation, for example, that culture is finished. Does that help, Lise?
Yes, I understand the ritual versus the community. But in the greater scheme of things, if it doesn't change society and if it doesn't make life better on earth, then it's just a community following rituals. Sure, they're all connected. But I mean, we've seen it here in Quebec. We were all connected. The small villages, that's all they had were these rituals in the church, and they couldn't go anywhere. There was no roads, whatever. But it didn't fundamentally change society for the better. So they're disconnected now, okay, and I understand that part with culture. But in the bigger picture, I don't see how just ritual and community has an eternal effect.
I think Skip, there's a facet of
okay,
so has to be part of it. The ritual and the traditions have to be connected to God's will.
Yeah, sure, because Sachs would argue there were plenty of pagan rituals as well, but they didn't have eternal effect because they weren't connected to God's will. So Leviticus gives us the rituals that are connected with God's will, okay?
Yeah.
But there are plenty of other rituals. They provide this societal glue, but that doesn't mean that, as Lise pointed out, that doesn't mean that they have eternal effect. It doesn't even mean that they will actually alter the society to be a better place. It just means that they hold a society together.
Okay.
And what we want are rituals. We want rituals that hold a society together and fulfill the will of God at the same time.
If you look at the rituals that are only done in the flesh, in the churches, and you go on Sunday and you do whatever the rituals are, and that's a good thing, or you go on whatever day you would go on, if you look at what happens in Judaism, and let me tell you, Lise, you're right. The young people, including in Israel, many of them don't. Although the hostages that are coming back are suddenly going back to their roots. The guys are talking about tefillin and what it does, and they're coming back, and they do. Please, God, it should stay that way. But it's the rituals that in the Jewish community are not just done on Shabbat in a synagogue or on Saturday night when we do Havdalah. We have things that we bring together with the family. The holidays are weeks long. You know, the holiday season from Rosh Hashanah through Simchat Torah makes you crazy if you're working it. But it's something everybody looks forward to. Then there's the off-biblical ones, the Chag, that also keep you together. Everybody knows Hanukkah. Whether they do it or not, they all know Purim. Whether they do it or not, and then comes Passover. So it's things that bring families together, whether you're religious or you're not, and there are many that aren't. and I don't mean overly religious, I'm talking about observant, but in yeah. some form, majority, not everybody, has some of them, and it connects them to, and I can't tell you if Judaism is different because it's sure. this connection to the world.
Yeah. And as Lee's point, there can be lots of other communities with rituals. I mean, you know, Roseanne is Catholic. She has Sicilian rituals that they went from the time she was a little kid. But we're not saying ritual is good in and of itself. What we're saying is ritual provides community identity. Now the question is, what kind of identity is it?
In regards to Judaism and Jews, I also feel like the history, even if you're not religious or you don't practice, for some reason it seems our history tends to cause a collective identity, you know.
Yeah.
Because my mom wasn't very religious at all.
Yeah.
But she had a very strong collective identity with Jews, you know, as that.
Yeah, but understand that, but understand why that's the case. Had she disconnected from the community and not been part of it, that history wouldn't be hers. Right? It's collective identity because the religion, again and again and again, generation after generation after generation, which creates the history. Right? And the best example I can give you is think about people who immigrated from Europe into the United States and assimilated. Okay? They had plenty of rituals. They left them behind. Right. And when that happened, over time, that history no longer is their shared history. Right? Okay. Let's continue.
One more.
Okay. This is on.
One more thing.
32. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, Skip.
Okay.
This will be short. I just want to give an example.
Okay.
So I raised my kids kind of religious. And then when we entered into the Messianic community, we joined a group that were rabidly against Easter and Christmas. And, I mean, it was just awful. And so we stopped practicing those things. And it really tore our family apart. I mean, like instantly. Almost tore our family apart, and we had to really soften and learn a lesson from that. And you're right. Those traditions, even though the kids didn't really know what they were about, we had a whole family history of stuff, including all the ornaments and everything that went with it, you know, from grandma. And it did. It gave them a sense of belonging. So it does. It is the glue, whether you understand or not.
Yep. Yep. And the thing is, you can certainly alter the glue, but you can't keep the stickiness if you tear it apart. You have to do it softly, a little bit at a time, right? Okay, let's go to 32, the bottom paragraph, the bottom line in the middle paragraph. He says, he's talking about the funeral thing, but though Jews died, Judaism did not. And because Judaism did not die, neither will the memories of those who did. Ritual is the defeat of nihilism, the failure of meaning when there is nothing to contain it. Okay, so he's just defined nihilism, right? The failure of meaning. In other words, nihilism is there's no purpose, no meaning of life. And what he says is ritual defeats that because it's even if you don't understand it, it tells you that there's a purpose, that there's some meaning to what I do. It connects me to other people, to family, right? Why do I decorate the Christmas tree? Because it connects me with the tradition that I understand from my childhood that's been an essential part of who I am, right? That's happening with just ritual as itself. Now what we're going to find out in Leviticus is how we define ritual in terms of what God wants. Okay? So let's go over to the bottom of 33, the last couple of sentences. To put it at its simplest, Torah is the word of God to man. The prophetic books are the words of God through man. The other writings are the words of God of man to God. So that's really cool because what that says is those first five books tell me God speaking to me. The prophets are God speaking to me through somebody else. And all the rest of the writings are me speaking back to God. If I keep that in mind, it helps me understand the division and also helps me figure out what's really going on in those other books like Proverbs, Psalms, Song of Song, Ecclesiastes, right? I don't look so much for God's message to me as I look for how do these human beings express their message back to God. Okay? Let's go to the next page, 34. The middle paragraph, second paragraph, where it starts, these voices are as different as rectangles and circles. He says in there, the question answered by the literary structure of Torah is, how do you convey in language intelligible to humans something that is beyond human? Okay, so here's this theme coming through of God as the holy other, right? Okay, and then he says, the next paragraph, the Torah's solution is the device of multiple perspectives. This is really helpful. God discloses himself in three ways, creation, redemption, and revelation. Creation means the world that is, the wonders of nature, the vicissitudes of history, the conflict between human heart and desire of duty and desire. Redemption is the world that ought to be, a world of justice, compassion, the dignity of the individual, the sanctity of life, the world God had in mind when he created humankind and to which we are still traveling. Revelation is the word that decodes the world. It is the set of instructions, the mitzvot, God has given for us for reaching him. Revelation is what happens when we are put, or when we put the world aside and listen to the will of God, right? This is really cool because now this tells me when I go to a biblical text, I need to decide which of those three categories it's really in, right? Is it an expression of the magnificence of the creation, as Heschel would say, the awe, the wonder of being, right? Is it an expression of what God hopes to accomplish, what God intended to accomplish, what redemption will all be about? And notice that in this term, under these terms, redemption has not yet occurred. We're still on the way there, okay? And the last one, of course, is revelation. And that's what happens when we put the world aside and listen to the will of God, right? So it's great that he summarized this so well. So then he says in the next paragraph, each of these disclosures has its own voice. The one associated with recreation is called Chokmah, wisdom. This is the voice we hear from the books like Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Job. Then he goes, the voice of redemption is prophetic. This is on the next page. The prophet sees God in history and sees history itself as the ongoing drama. Okay. For the prophets, time is not a mere series of events. Okay. He says it is the story of God's love for Abraham, et cetera, et cetera. And then skip down a couple more paragraphs. The voice of revelation is priestly. So now we're going to be into the Levitical work. Unlike the prophet and the king, the priest does not live in the world of every day. Okay? Wait a minute. Leviticus is going to tell us how to act in this world as if we were in the next, as if we were living. This is what God intended. Okay? I just got a message that says my internet cut off. Did you hear what I said? Are we still connected?
We're connected.
But we missed the two words.
Yeah, we missed that.
Okay. So what I said is when he says at the top of that in the paragraph on page 35, the second paragraph, the voice of revelation is priestly. Unlike the prophet and the king, the priest does not live in the world of every day. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that the instructions that I get in Leviticus are not about what the world is like now. It's what the world should be like. In other words, it's as though the priest is standing in a place where the will of God saturates everything, and he's revealing to us, he's writing about what it's like to be in perfect alignment with God. That's Leviticus. Leviticus isn't instructions about, you know, how you're going to take care of this and take care of that. Leviticus is looking at the world from the perspective of God's intention, so that it's the ultimate perfection of human and godly relationships. Okay? Look what he says the rest of that paragraph. He is the guardian of sacred space and time, the points at which we will withdraw from the world and remind ourselves of eternity. Okay? Now he says in the next paragraph, put these three voices together and you have a literary expression of the fact that God, as he speaks to us in the Torah, cannot be confined to a single perspective or vantage point. Okay? So what he's saying is you're going to look for all three. Yes?
Yep. You went too fast on that last sentence. It's really, for me, that was like the answer to today's ills of arrogance.
Okay. Let's go back then. So we'll do this paragraph again. The voice of revelation is priestly. Unlike the prophet and the king, the priest does not live in the world of every day, right? What world does he live in? The world of God's intention. He's the guardian of space and time, sacred space and time. The points at which we withdraw from the world to remind ourselves how small we are and how brief our lives, milliseconds in the history of the cosmos, yet how great they can be when we allow others to be brushed by the wings of eternity. Okay? So the whole idea of Leviticus is to paint what the world should look like. And the closer that I draw to the intention, the closer I will draw to God, and the more my world will take on the aspects of the ultimate redemption that God has in mind of bringing the world back into alignment with himself. Okay? Now, next paragraph. Put these three voices together and you have a literary expression of the fact that God, as he speaks to us through Torah, cannot be confined to a single perspective or vantage point. So, what does that mean? Every time I read the text, I should be looking for, wait a minute, is this about the creation of God, the magnificence of God? Is it about the ultimate intention of God, the revelation of God? Or is it about the sacredness, the space that I have to have? Where do I fall in this category, right? Which one of those three categories is this verse in, and how does it relate? And then he goes on. He is the one within many, the unity beneath the diversity, the whole that makes parts cohere. Okay? Here's the sentence. The God of creation, the God of redemption, and the God of revelation are one and the same. And I have a little marginal note. And my marginal note says, this is Judaism's view of the Trinity. One God, three perspectives. Not three gods, one being, but one God with three perspectives. The perspective of creation, redemption, and revelation. Okay? So, he says at the end, beyond space and time where the many are one. The truth, the Torah is the primal literary expression of the monotheistic mind. Okay? The primal literary expression of the monotheistic mind is one God, three different perspectives. Okay. Now, let's go to the bottom of the page.
Skip, can I interrupt just a minute and go back to something that we were talking about ritual being keeping us together? And I just got a blurb that just flashed my screen. And it says, it says, hostages clung to Judaism, sustained by faith. The hostages clung to Judaism in the darkest of places. So it was just to go along with what we were talking about with rituals. So I just thought
isn't it interesting? And just this, I think it's an important point, but just this interesting comment. Isn't it interesting that it took a dramatic, cataclysmic event in the lives of those people to push them to reconnect with their identity, with their cultural identity. And, so what that tells me is that the greatest enemy to my spirituality is prosperity and complacence.
So just one of the hostages, and I will stop after this, but one of the hostages said that the first tunnel he was in had a crack of light The second tunnel we had no light, but had a tiny light that they put in it, a very tiny light. So he would talk to the cracker light, then he talked to the light, and the last tunnel he was in for, I think, 200 days, had no light, and that's when he started talking to God.
Yep.
So.
Okay. Let's go. I want to go to the bottom of the page, page 35, to the footnote. I hope you read the footnotes. Okay. Jeremiah, he says, Jeremiah refers to the three when he says, for the teaching of the law by the priest will not cease, nor will counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophets. Likewise, Ezekiel, they will go searching for a vision from the prophets. Priestly instruction in the law will cease. The counsel of the elders will come to an end. So isn't it interesting that if you have those three categories in mind, you can actually find the prophet saying exactly the same thing. We probably read those verses in the prophets and never thought, you know what? There's three different perspectives on what's happening here, right? And there it is in that footnote. Okay, let's go to the next page, 36. Three forms of moral life, he says. And this is, now he's going to give you a little philosophical history. Right under that, three forms of moral life, the second paragraph, from Plato onward, philosophers have given us elegant simplifications of morality. Elegant simplifications of morality. Okay. Right. And what does that lead to? Well, as he's going to tell you, if you simplify morality down to its basic terms, you leave all kinds of questions unanswered because morality turns out to be found in the many, not in the one. Okay, so it goes on. Look at the bottom of, he says, there is a wisdom morality set out of the book of Proverbs, and you go down a little bit apart, and it says, and I have this quote from 1430, a heart at peace gives life to the body, in 1430. Learn from experience. Keep the company of the sages, avoid conflict whenever possible, and be ever mindful of God. And now he's still on this theme, and he goes over to 37. Now he says, the voice of Chokmah, wisdom. And he says in the second paragraph there, wisdom is about creation. That is, the here and now, the real empirical everyday world in which most people find themselves most of the time. Its ideal type is the Chacham, the wise man. Or better still, the wise woman. Proverbs 1-9 sees wisdom as a female attribute, and the bookends of the famous hymn of praise in the Ashit Ha'il, the woman of moral strength. Its approach to morality, while deeply religious, is also prudential, pragmatic, and experience-based. There is more oriented to virtue than there is to real-based morality. To rule-based morality, okay? Why is that important? Because what he's arguing is that rules alone do not provide a morality. I can keep all the rules and still be an immoral person, right? Why? Because look what he says at the bottom of the paragraph. Those who keep them flourish, those who flout them eventually fail. The best way of acquiring a moral sense is to live constantly with Yirah Hashem, with the fear of God, awe in the conscious presence of God. That is, I have my marginal note says, Luzado. That is Musar, to understand that it is the awe and the fear, Yirah, of God that creates the moral purpose of my life. In other words, if I'm only rule-oriented, I will always find a way around it. I will always find a legitimate way to avoid keeping a rule. I will find an exception. I will find an exclusion, right? In Roman culture, I would find justification for my actions based on some argument, okay? But that's not what Sachs is talking about. What he's saying is morality can't be based simply on rules. It has to come from this idea of a sense of the presence of God that overwhelms me to the point of being in awe and therefore fearing to do anything that would jeopardize that. Okay? In other words, The morality has to come from an experiential level, not from a cognitive set of rules. And I argued this when I was teaching in the undergraduate level years and years ago, when people would come with a set of rules and say, if I keep all these rules, then I will be a, you know, saved person. And I would argue with them that that's not what was happening at all. That if your life is only based on the rules, you've missed the whole point. The rules are just an expression of something else, some experiential basis for why you want to act that way. Okay? All right. So let's go and see how he develops this on page 38. Remember, we talked about the priest living in the world of God's intention, beyond space and time. It's at the top of the page, first sentence. If the voice of wisdom lives in the present, the prophet lives in the future. The prophet is also the bearer of the word. He or she speaks not as wisdom does on the basis of observation and experience, but rather on the basis of the word of God that has planted in his mouth a message. He has charged him with delivering. The prophets were often deeply conflicted people, feeling inadequate to the task they had been given by God, knowing that what they had to say would be unpopular and almost certainly unheeded. Isaiah said he had unclean lips. Jeremiah attempted to be silent. Jonah tried to run away. Yet in the end, they delivered God's word. Okay? I underline that because I think we often misunderstand the spiritual and emotional conflict that happens in the prophets. I mean, literally, these are men and women whom God tears apart, right? He asks them to deliver his message, and many, many times it's at great jeopardy to themselves, often at harm, and certainly at internal conflict, right? So it's important when we read the prophets to read the feelings that go in, not just the words that they deliver, but the emotional trauma that happens in the delivery of those words. Okay? And he goes on to say, next paragraph, the key words of the prophet are tzedek and mishpat, social and legal justice, chesed and rachamim, kindness and compassion. A prophet thinks in terms of relationships, right? How does a priest think? The priest thinks in terms of the ultimate purposes, right? The prophet thinks in terms of relationships, right? Between rich and poor, powerful and powerless, et cetera, et cetera. You all see society with the human face, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Now we can go to the other page, 39, top first sentence, first full sentence. Love is an alignment of the human deed and the divine will. Love your neighbor as yourself because your neighbor, too, is the image of God. Love the stranger because we are all ultimately strangers and temporary residents on earth. Never give away to the emotion that disturbs the order of society. Okay? So what he's saying is, I need the priestly input to see what God's ultimate intention is. Then the prophet comes along and delivers a sometimes harsh message about how far I am removed from that ultimate intention and demands that my relationships improve so that the ultimate intention can take place. Okay? One more thing. The next paragraph, about half the way down. If for the sage, the key virtue is wisdom, for the prophet, justice and compassion, for the priest, it is obedience. Okay? So now we have the three components, three different perspectives on how to read the Torah, okay, or how to read the scripture, the Tanakh. And now we have three different voices going on. And now we have three different obligations. Wisdom, justice and compassion, and obedience. Okay? And as we think of the Tanakh in those terms, we'll have a much better appreciation for what's actually happening in the literature. Okay? So he says, finally, at the end of that one paragraph, when human act coincides with divine will, order is safeguarded against the ever-present threat of chaos. Okay? Now take that sentence and apply it to what's happening today. When human act coincides with divine will, Well, what happens when it doesn't coincide with divine will? Right? The ever-present threat of chaos. So the further the society gets away from the coincidence of divine will and human act, the closer it gets to ultimate chaos. You want to absolutely destroy a society? You remove not just its rituals, which is its communal identity, but the divine purpose behind the ritual, which removes its meaning. And the result is the emergence of chaos. And once that gets going, it's pretty hard to stop. Okay? So, one more thing. Okay. So, then he says, this is really interesting, because in the next page, top of 40, for the priest, the moral life is not something we learn by observation, the wisdom ethic, or by empathy and passion for justice, the prophetic ethic, but by honoring the distinctions God has taught us to see in the structure of reality. This is interesting. There is milk, a sign of life, and meat, a sign of death. And why did I underline that? Because there's this huge argument that goes on about how come there's milk and, you know, what's the separation of meat and dairy all about? I mean, why do we have to worry about that? It's just some verse that had to do with a pagan ritual boiled in the mother's milk, all that kind of stuff. But look what Sachs has done. He said, don't you understand that the priest is giving you, he's not giving you ethics based on experience, observation. You do the scientific evidence. That's empirical stuff. You don't come up with that solution. He's not giving you wisdom from the sages. What he's giving you is, the priest is giving you the structure of reality that God teaches. In other words, remember we went all the way back, that the priest is responsible for bordering things. What falls inside the border, what comes outside the border. He's responsible for making the distinctions. He's responsible for defining where the lines are. And in this case, as Sachs points out, it's really simple. Milk is about life. Meat is about death. Meat is associated with killing. Meat is about death. Milk is associated with nurturing. Milk is about life. The two have a borderline between them. Right? That's all. And, you know, suddenly that whole command, which has been investigated by all kinds of scientific means and explanation and everything else, suddenly it takes on a different meaning. Because now it's not about my experience of it. It's simply about reordering my paradigm so that I fit within the priestly instructions that are supposed to tell me the way God intended things to be. And now I can go back and see that when God allows meat following Noah, he makes a concession, right? He makes a concession to reality, not an exception, okay? All right.
Yep. Yeah. I've never heard that. So, I mean, in everything that I've read on Leviticus, all the discussions we've had with you and Rabbi,
yeah,
we've never heard that. And yet we talked about it. Often we talked about it and we said, well, we don't know. It comes from the pagans. It's just supposed to be the way it is, right?
Yes.
And all of a sudden it falls in this book. So where does he take this? Like, how come we never saw it before?
Because we didn't have Sachs' genius for understanding what was actually happening in the text.
Yeah, but he has to have taken it.
I mean, that's basically what
he didn't invent it, right?
He had insights from God.
Yeah, it's not.
Oh, no, he didn't invent it. I'm sure it comes from some libertarian. Yeah.
But it's,
I mean,
it's
the whole
really
point is he's helping us. Oh, I'm losing my.
I was going to say it's not about the food at all.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And isn't that interesting? Because now what we've realized that Leviticus isn't about empirical reality, right? That's the wisdom sages, you know, act like this because it makes sense, right? That's empirical reality. The priestly document is not about empirical reality. It's about the way that God intends things to be ultimately finished, okay? And so now we've got an insight into why that's the case. Okay.
I find it super interesting that whole order and not order and boundaries. I mean, I find that really, really instructive, and it's like a revelation to me to see it put in that way on the page. I just was completely surprised that we had never read it anywhere else. So,
yeah,
but I really like it.
Yeah.
Hi, yeah. Skip. Skip.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm just thinking, if you go back, are we done? Because I just want to go back to that holy other. Is it possible? Is it possible that he is not referring to the philosophy of God as completely other, but that he's saying that if you read the paragraph before, he's saying that he's talking about all the other gods that are placating, you know, this, that they, you know, rainmakers bringing rain and all of that. All this is true, but such beliefs are alien to Judaism, that God is wholly other than that, than the other, you know, gods and mystics.
Yes. Yes, I would, and I appreciate your generosity in extending that idea to sex. I'm afraid, and it's true that the God of Israel is different than all those other pagan gods for exactly the reason that you said. But I would, but I think that as we get into the next, say, 200 pages or so of this book, you're going to discover that sex still has this carryover from philosophy.
Okay.
It's okay. I mean, it's, you know, it doesn't hurt anything. You just have to be aware. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So I see that, let's see. Has anybody else got a hand up? No. Okay. So, are we good? Have we reached the crisis and return of the holy? Should we continue or do we stop? Let me see. Oh no, let's just finish this section because I only have one more comment and then we're going to skip all the way to 46. And the next comment is on page 41 where he says, "It was in exile in Babylon that Torah rose to a prominence in the life of the nation that it rarely had before. Because, and by the way, this reflects on Lindy's comment. Why does Torah rise to a prominence it never had before if it was always there? Because it takes cataclysm and strife and conflict to force people to reconnect with the glue that holds their society together. So it was in Babylon that Torah took off, right? Because it was now the very basis of the nation's identity. Right? He says, a people in exile have by definition lost all other things that made them a nation. Their land, home, language, landscape, independence, and sovereignty. That is why they almost invariably assimilate into the dominant culture and, whether voluntarily or under pressure, adopt the dominant faith. And that is exactly why Judaism survived. It did not assimilate. Of course, some of the people did. A lot of the people did. But the reason that it survived is because it refused to assimilate. Whereas you can look at all the other cultures that I talk about when I'm traveling in the Mediterranean. The Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Carthaginians, the Saracens, all, you know, it's assimilation, assimilation, assimilation. And what happens is the culture morphs each time. It still has remnants, but it starts to change. Okay?
Skip, just out of curiosity, isn't sometimes it's forced assimilation?
Of course. Look at what happened with Christianity and the Roman Empire. The Caesars declared entire areas Christian. And if you didn't go along, you were executed. Look at the Inquisition. It's the same thing. It's forced assimilation into a cultural norm. Okay? So it isn't always because people were just ignorant, lazy, or volunteered. It was sometimes forced upon them. But what's really interesting is this. The cultures that refused to assimilate maintained their cultural identity. Okay? Judaism is the one that has a very long history. There are a couple of others in the world. Chinese culture typically does not assimilate. right? You can find Chinatown all over the world. It does not assimilate. It maintains its own language, its own religious practices, its own cuisine, etc. Okay? The other one, of course, is Islam. Islam does not assimilate on purpose. Why? Because Islam believes that it is the dominant culture of the world and everyone else must adopt it, right? So where you see those practices occur within a society, you do not have an integrated society. You have a Chinatown in San Francisco. You have a Vietnamese town in Seattle where the street signs are in Vietnamese. The ballots are in Vietnamese, et cetera, et cetera. And when that happens, you don't have assimilation and the culture begins to fragment. The only reason that Judaism survived is because it doesn't assimilate. Okay? It still maintains its own culture, its own cuisine, its own rituals, its own language, right? It has to maintain that or the culture will disappear. And so this, even though we're talking about going into Babylon as the thing that forced Judaism to emphasize its national identity, right, and kept it together, wherever you see that in modern society today, you have a fragmented society. You don't have a uniform society anymore. And the more that happens, the more damage to the society as a whole will happen. Okay? That's the last thing I have until we get to the next section, which is on page 46, right? The next section, page 46, Leviticus today. So I think we'll stop here because now you won't have to think about Leviticus today until next week. And you can ponder all these things until we get to Leviticus today next week. There's a lot of good stuff in that next couple of. It's actually only a couple of pages till we get to Vayikra. That's okay. We'll quit here anyway. It's been we spent a little bit of time talking about this today. Okay. Any other comments and questions before we sign off?
Just very enlightening. I find it really really enlightening. And then eventually we're going to get into the sins and the kind of sins and the sacrifice. And I went into Hebrews last night and I thought, who wrote Hebrews? This doesn't even sound like what I'm reading in Jonathan's textbook. And I thought, this is complete disconnect. I couldn't get my head around it. And I've been reading Hebrews for 40 years, but it just did not make any sense at all in light of what we're reading today.
So when we get to, if and when we ever get to Hebrews, then I'll defer to my friend Bob Gorlick, who said to one of the people that he was talking to about Hebrews, oh, but didn't you understand? It's a midrash. And of course, midrashes don't make any sense at all in terms of this is the actual stuff, right? It's a midrash. So we'll get there. Okay. But in the meantime, we're going to try to figure out what the constitution of the cultural identity of Israel is by understanding what the priests were talking about when they were talking about what the ideal world would look like. Okay. Anybody else? Comments? No? We're good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.